My name is Christine Carlson. I'm the village philosopher, and I'd like to welcome you to our Thursday evening forum. We will talk together for an hour and end right at 8:30, and the conversation can certainly continue after that, but just so you know, you can count on a good hour together here. I want to welcome our panelists first, Mark, Ivana here, Mark, Duane, and Kristen. Kristen is Holden Village's artist, and if you were here on Tuesday, you heard her speak at the Vespers service and saw her new banner hanging up. Duane is our Bible study leader, and so perhaps you've been coming to his Bible studies in the morning. And Mark is our ethicist this week and has been speaking a lot about ethical issues and decision making, but also about Bonhoeffer. And so welcome to you panelists. I thought I would, to begin, to introduce our topic of worship and politics, that I would offer up some touch points from the past week that have raised up this issue for me and for our panelists, and hopefully this will kind of gather us together to begin to think about this subject. Last Friday evening, we worshiped again with prayer around the cross, and have the names of the Americans and Iraqis and other nationalities who have been killed in the war in Iraq on the wall of the chapel, and candles were snuffed as we remember the mothers, the fathers, the grandparents, the children who have died. After that Friday evening service, someone said to one of the directors, "I could not worship with that service. It was a political statement. It didn't feel like worship to me." So there's one touch point. Another touch point, maybe you were here when Lima, from the woman from Liberia, who has been a leader in the Women's Peace Initiative in Liberia, was speaking. And the women who are bringing peace to Liberia right now are church women, very inspired by their faith to seek peace and to put their lives on the line for that. Kristen's banner went up last Friday in our worship space, and we lived with that over the weekend and then heard her speak about that on Tuesday night. Last night, some of you were
here. One of the comments made in Lema's presentation is someone raised their hand and said, "How do we start this movement in the United States in order to bring peace?" And I think that's a good touch point as well. I just wanted to put that up. I thought that was a wonderful comment.
Yes, that is. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Some of you were in this room last night watching the Bonhoeffer film, which was just moving and gripping, and I couldn't get to sleep last night thinking about this man and the church in Germany at that time and our own situation here in the United States. One of the things that Mark shared last night after the movie was over and we were discussing was that eventually in the Confessing Church, which was the church that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a part of in Germany, after Dietrich Bonhoeffer was arrested and it was known that he was part of the resistance movement that sought to assassinate Adolf Hitler, those Confessing Churches no longer prayed for him. To pray for him was too political an act. And Mark will talk more about that. The Bible studies that Duane has been leading every day have talked about this body of Christ in the world and what we're being called out to be, being delivered, nurtured in this womb of God, and then delivered to what kind of life? And then worship tonight was another touch point, singing African American spirituals, listening to Zoe sing Deep River, a great political cry for people living in our own nation in slavery to cross the Deep River into Jordan. That's not talking only about the heavenly life, that's right now. So these are some of the touch points that have gathered up in our village and our common experience together to raise up this issue of worship and politics. So with those laid out, I'll ask each of the panelists to share their thoughts, and then we can get a conversation going. Dwayne's going to speak first, but just before he does, I want to review again what sense of forum we're operating in here. Forums sometimes are, you know, debate sessions, point, counterpoint, and you argue it out. And that's not the style of forum that we had last week or that we will seek to foster this week. The sense of forum that I hope we can enter into tonight and covenant with each other to participate in is much more a public, informed conversation that we seek to build together, listening to one another, responding to each other. Peter Thompson, when he introduced the Iraq the forum on Iraq last week, he called it a family conversation. It's a little more public. We're a little more strangers to each other than we would be in a family. But we promise one another tonight, and I hope you will join me in that, to listen, to respect one another, and then to share. And together, I hope we will build an informed conversation together on worship and politics. So thank you for coming. Dwayne, do you want to speak first?
Okay. Thank you all, too, for coming. A couple of points to get some things started. I want to say something about just the usual definition of politics, but then make the assertion that worship is inescapably political, as over and against being partisan. That's one thing I want to say. And then I want to say just a word about how Lutherans understand ourselves to be empowered by such worship to do what we said we were going to do in our affirmation of baptismal vows. So I think those are some points that could get us rolling. The first thing is simply this, that to do politics is the inevitable action that must happen when two or three or more are gathered to talk about self-interests. And the art of politics, this is simply in the secular vein, is the matter of trying to meet any number of self-interests with limited resources. That's where you set up the problem for any conversation and how you get at them some sort of consensus that's agreeable to all. That's a distinctly political and civil conversation to be had. It becomes partisan when you insert competing ideologies into the calculus. And then we often think it's political when we would say something Republican or Democrat, that's partisan. But to be political, to be human in a community together. The liturgy. Once we deal with things like overcoming the conflicts of self-interests, we confess those at the beginning of the liturgy, and we get on with knowing that the Lord has absolved us of all of that. The liturgy is then meant to not only be a foretaste of the feast to come, but a preview of the heavenly city to come. In fact, an anticipation of what the Christian public life will be like, should be like, for all of us in our mission. Finally, what the reign of God will be all in all. One perhaps gets the best sense of that out of the Eastern tradition of Christianity, where it's just clearly seen that the experience of worship is to be the very present tense vision of the heavenly city and the life that is celebrated therein. That stands underneath the ancient liturgy. Its echoes come forward to us in our doing the liturgy these days, such that even the passing of the peace, which in too many places has devolved into a hi, how are you, good to see you, kind of shake hands thing, it's meant to be a profound overcoming of the conflicts that can almost be inevitable when political concerns turn partisan. And so the passing of the peace even is that reconciling time again, where the heavenly city is at peace, so then rightly to receive the Lord's body and blood, to be empowered for its mission again. Finally, Lutherans have a particular take on being political while not being partisan in worship, and that is that the doctrine of justification by grace through faith is meant especially for us to be boldly political in our private yet also very public lives, because we see that we can do politics and we ought to be about the care of a neighbor and meeting of others' interests because our salvation does not depend on it. It's quite another thing if we think our righteousness depends upon us doing a certain thing. And that's where politics really becomes partisan and fracturing. If we would suppose that righteousness coheres with a certain kind of ideology put into a certain kind of situation. Justification says, I don't have to earn stars on my crown. Christ did it for me. Now I can go forth and use my mind as God gave me well to use, put it to the good civil use, so to anticipate finally in this day the coming city in the midst of the political world that we inhabit.
Well, I wanted to share a couple of examples from the Nazi Germany period that I think might trigger some thoughts. And then I want to share briefly how we responded in our congregation at Trinity Lutheran in Tacoma in terms of worship to the 9/11, events of 9/11, and then also to the buildup in preparation for war with Iraq. And I wanted to lift up something that may have been, I think, a positive thing that we did, and then also a confession that I think we probably were inadequate, and some would say woefully inadequate, in our response to the buildup to the war in Iraq in terms of what we did even in worship. In terms of worship, it's not only the liturgy, but it's the worship space. There's something about worship space that we need to take into account. And a wonderful story, a very moving story, was told by an Old Testament professor I had at LSTC, who was from Austria. And when the Nazis came to power in Austria, his dad was a pastor in church there in Austria. And the Nazis came and held a meeting in the sanctuary of his church and put a picture of Adolf Hitler on the altar. And as he tells the story, as his father just came, entered right into the meeting, just opened the doors, walked right down the aisle, and laid the picture down, face down on the altar, and walked out. They ended up having to emigrate, and that's why Walter Mickel ended up being a professor here in this country. But that was a profound act in the worship space, a very political act, but saying no to what was going on there, where clearly a political group had co-opted the worship space itself. So I lift that up. Then just in relationship to the point about not praying for Bonhoeffer, the confessing church had a practice that developed, where they developed a intercession lists of people who had been detained, arrested, banned from speaking in public, and so on, included clergy and lay people. And this list then would distributed, and the names would simply be read during worship in these confessing churches. So that was the practice. And what was striking then is finally when they discovered that Bonhoeffer had been involved in this conspiracy, that's when his name was left off the list. So simply who you pray for has political consequences, and it was very clear the Nazis, they went after those lists. They were very concerned about who was being prayed for in these confessing churches. In terms of response to 9/11, when it happened, I happened to be in a place where the Pacific Lutherans on one side and the bishop, the synod office, is a house on our block that we own. So I'm very blessed with people on both sides there at the church. And the bishop wanted to do something in response, and he teaches worship. I mean, worship, he really has a heart and a passion for worship. And he said, is there something we can do jointly? Well, we held a prayer service, and we invited various people. We had very few people show up, but we did it in our little chapel there. And what we finally decided was to light three candles, and one was a candle of remembrance for any of the victims of 9/11, and did a brief meditation on that. We also had a third candle we knew of, was the candle of reconciliation, and we wanted to pray for reconciliation. But the second candle we finally came to was a candle of repentance, that we thought was important that as a church we take a lead in looking at not only what others had done, but how had we ourselves, what did we need to confess and repent in relationship to the events of 9/11. Attendance, like I said, there were very few people came. We invited leaders from the congregation. It was a great idea that nobody showed up for it, one of those kinds of things that often happens in the church. But we did then continue for, and I don't remember when we finally ended this, but we continued to light those three candles every Sunday in worship, and so that at least people were aware of those emphases in terms of, and it helped shape the prayers that we did. So that was one example. In terms of the buildup for the war in Iraq, now, we have an Air Force base that's 2 miles away, and then one of the largest Army bases in the country in Fort Lewis, all right there in our area. So, and we have a number of military people in our congregation. We have and a number of people would be very strongly in support of the war effort and would be strongly in support of what the administration did. We also have a lot of people that are definitely on the other end of the spectrum. So that's the kind of what you're dealing with there. My sense is that in situations like that, preaching as part of the worship needs to some, cannot ignore major issues like that. And as I look back on that, I haven't sorted this all out yet, but I have this sense that someday I'm going to look back on that and be able to say, missed some moments that where I needed to say things that did not get said, and not only myself, but others that are leaders in the congregation. That it's not like we ignored it. I don't want to give you that impression. But we were trying to find our way between these different groups, and sometimes you can get so afraid of offending people that you'll please no one and end up offending them anyway. The one thing, I could say things, and about every 3 or 4 months, there's somehow a sermon that says we can't put our trust in military power and might for our security. And that's an ongoing theme. So that one you can do, and people will they'll understand that. People of faith understand that you can't put your ultimate trust in military power and might. You simply can't do that. But I'm not sure. As I look back, I don't have this sense that we said enough. And we dealt with that enough, and in particular in the worship life. We'll pray for the victims, of course, we continue to do that, but there were other things I think that needed to be said that didn't get said in worship. And worship is the time when the largest number of people in the community are gathered, no matter what, we had other programs, adult education and that, but the gathering time of the community is that worship time, and that's why it's such a vital and essential time to be used to address these kinds of things.
Well, I'm not a teacher or a theologian, but I am an artist, and I care passionately about things. And I was moved to do the banner that's hanging in the Village Center that is a commentary on brutality and war and abuse by the events that I heard of on the radio and by a particular picture in the New York Times that I just happened to pick up, unawares that I was going to see a terrible abuse of humanity. It shook me, like I said the night before. And what I see, when I made that, it wasn't to be political. It was to point out a disconnect between what I've been raised with in my Lutheran and Christian values about who we are as people of faith and how we treat others as children of God, and the disconnect between that and what I'm still hearing today on the radio about how our nation and those that we fund through our taxes, how they are not treating people as even dogs. That is maybe too harsh a statement, but I don't think so, since the I've heard that that's what the soldiers were trained to treat the people, the prisoners, like was dogs. So I'm feeling a great disconnect between my faith and what my nation is doing. And where am I to bring that but to God? Where are we to bring what's deepest in our souls but to God? And who can we share that with if we can't share that with each other in faith? And I also know that I was able to put that banner up here at Holden Village, but I really don't think it would have lasted for 2 minutes in my home congregation in Bonners Ferry, Idaho, because things get pretty polarized in our congregation there. I think it works here because we can have forums and we can talk about things like this with each other in a safe fashion. And I think there's a lot to learn from that to bring back to our home congregations.
One more thing, Kristen. Would you share just a little bit, since you were here as part of the Winter Community, how that service evolved?
Ooh, Scott? Scott was a big part of that. Okay. Would you speak to that,
Scott? Oh, Scott, you're over here. I'm sorry. I got my back turned to you.
When the number of U.S. deaths passed 500 back in January or so, one of the community members brought it to a community meeting and saying he was recognizing this and had seen a ritual remembrance of this in the papers, where there were 500 pairs of boots, empty boots, being placed somewhere. It's kind of just a reminder of what the cost has been of the war. And he brought it to the community and said, we want to do something about this ourselves. He was very clear that his passion was just that it stopped. That's all he wants. This has to stop. We just want to stop. We don't care why. We don't care how. We just want to stop. That was the sentiment behind it. And then we discussed it in the community over the course of several months, actually, in small groups and back in the large community, and thought of different ways of expressing our grief, our remorse, our anger, our sorrow at what's happening. One of the ideas was to line the road from Lucerne up to the village with not necessarily crosses, because it would be appropriate, but with markers, grave markers, kind of commemorating the 10 to 20,000 Iraqis who've been killed over there. We thought that would have been pretty powerful, but probably not legal and maybe a little bit over the top. And kind of came to the conclusion that a burnt out candle seemed like an appropriate symbol of the lives that were being lost there. And eventually came to a consensus that this was something the Winter Community wanted to share with the summer communities that come in worship, in particular.
Thanks. Well, thank you for sharing these thoughts, and I'd like to open up the conversation now, and we're eager to hear where you want to go with this.
I will start. I'm finding it really frustrating that partisanship is entering in. If you are a Christian, you don't necessarily, how can I say it? I think the administration and the Republican Party is taking a lot, is really trying to get conservative Christians and Christians supposedly as a part of their donor base, and he's, we're using, you know, sometimes if you're not, if people are saying if you're a Christian, you should be supporting this, you should be supporting us as America, because I don't know, but it feels like partisanship is entering in to religion in a very big way, more bold this election year it feels than I've seen in the past. And I think, you know, at some point we have to stand up and say, yeah, we're on the top of the fence in some churches, and yet other churches are very active in supporting a real conservative Christian, even in their donating of time and money. And it seems like there's not even a question. I guess I'm just saying I see politics, partisan politics, entering into religion in a way that's very bold right now. And I don't know how to respond to that.
There was a recommendation for those who could to try to get a glance at the Bill Moyers article in the current Sojourners. This article is an address delivered to a Sojourners conference, I believe. It's also available online. We'll get the address later. Bill's argument is that it's not only that a certain Republican, in fact, neocon group has gotten a hold of the religious right, it's that this has been a scripted piece or scripted strategy by Paul Warrick and others from the last decade and a half. So such that what you finally have is really an incredible and very disconcerting alliance that even conservative Christians may not be aware of. That if for example, you were to sign up within a conservative Christian church for a certain kind of a supportive agenda for the current administration or a current issue underneath Republican aegis, and no disrespect to the Republicans here, I'm really speaking about a neoconservative strategy, you're going to find yourself suddenly barraged with a whole lot of interesting different enticements or invitations to subscribe to things like the Weekly Standard, to National Review, to all sorts of other Republican and conservative Christian things. How is that? How is it that the mailing lists have become so enmeshed with each other? It's because it goes back further to even a business lobby that has a particular kind of a prayer group meeting in which a select few meet, which includes our vice president. So Bill Moyers, his concern is that it's not only the injection of a partisan agenda into Christianity and to claim that that's Christian. What in fact is doing is threatening the very character of democracy in the United States. So he asked Christians of all types to say, in this American experiment, it's time for other people to step forward and say, well, what happened to the prophetic Jesus? What about the one who kicks the changers out of the temple and so forth? Who exercises a different kind of politics than has been argued as warrant, religious warrant, for what's going on.
But the problem that most religions have, we'll study something to death before we're doing that. You take the gay homosexual thing, and regardless of where you are on the spectrum of recognize that marriage, we're going to have a thing in 2005. And I promise you there won't be a decision. It's going to be sent back to the local congregation to make up their own mind, or sent to another committee for another study for clarification. Vietnam comes to mind in many years because we're in a similar situation. How long did it take for the American public, starting in the early 60s, to determine that they were going to change Vietnam? And how did it happen? The way it happened, at least my analysis is, all the middle class kids and the other kids started getting killed over there, and the numbers were great. And all of a sudden, middle America's ox started getting gored because they were losing their kids. And you have a mother that says, yeah, I did, and I did, and I did, and are we gonna win the war, and why are we there? And you can elongate it out, but it takes a long time for the American public. World War II, for instance, the Americans wouldn't get into it. Roosevelt couldn't get the great American Congress to declare war until the Japanese bombed us. So that great middle America that we call is very slow. It's like a glacier. It moves so very slowly. And sometimes it passes us by before we do anything. And the fringes decide what we're doing.
So it's not only a Lutheran characteristic, but a middle-class characteristic in the United States, you're saying. Yeah. I saw John's hand, and then I saw another hand over here. Okay, John.
Just in concurrence with him, I was captain in the Army 68-70, served in Panama, not Vietnam, and he's absolutely right. The reason nothing is being done about this war now, and I use the term advisedly, we have a professional army, we don't have a volunteer army. You all don't have any people at risk for the draft. And that's what started the Vietnam peace movement, was the fact, what the gentleman said. When real people in middle America started having to send their boys and girls to serve, people came out in the streets.
We also have a huge disconnect with our administration.
Can you talk louder, please?
We have a huge disconnect with our administration. We really do not understand our administration, where they're coming from, what the purpose of all of this is. And without an understanding and feeling that we are in the fog, per se, we don't act.
Don't you think all the pictures we're seeing of the people that are very young, they do the bibo, a bit about them, their age, and you think, that could be my son, this could be my cousin. And the pictures, though, that really hit me are the pictures of the people over there that we're treating like animals. And I think we're the good guys and we're acting like Nazis.
But the number one argument in that, from those who've been in Vietnam as well as in World War II, is that anger breeds anger and hate breeds hate. And that is what war has all been all about.
When we're treating people, I mean, I think it really hit me very strongly, like I think it did you, the pictures, because people kept yelling at me at work, you know, that you know, we have to take Saddam Hussein out, that we've done this in Germany with Hitler. Mm-hmm. And they were never thinking that we could be Hitler, that Bush could be the Hitler. And I said that once and I got... Anyway, enough said.
You know, what I've noticed in our society is the information's not out there. So if you're educating the young people about what their government's up to, you know, they can make informed decisions about, you know, whether they want to go into the military or not. But, I mean, when I was just watching the films on Hitler, you know, few people know that Standard Oil fueled the German army a lot of the time. Henry Ford helped him set up his factories. DuPont was doing business with him. A lot of the business transactions went through Chase Manhattan Bank to pay for it. And, you know, a lot of people don't know it, but a lot of our corporations were supporting Hitler before we went into the war. And, you know, if we had more of that information coming out, and we had the truth about history, to the public as well as our young people, you know, we could, I think, make decisions a little bit sooner. And, you know, IBM supported Hitler. They set up punch cards for identifying the Jews who were going to go to the concentration camps. You know, a lot of people don't know that. And if they did, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't be as trusting as they are of a lot of the people who are in power today in this country.
I don't believe that about IBM. How would I find out?
Well, there's a book written about it.
Kristen?
I'd like to ask what place the church might have in all this.
Well, I mean, I think conflict on this is unavoidable, and you need, I think the church has a very important role to play, and I think that in worship we should not dodge conflict, but rather, you know, approach it as the body of Christ. And how we do that needs to be very sincere and very acknowledging of different views. And I think, you know, it's probably a mistake to probably just try and accomplish it in worship. But rather, you know, things like this and other opportunities, we might allow people to express themselves.
The problem is you're going to polarize. And I think that's what most congregations are afraid of, is polarizing your congregation into two different or three different camps and losing half of it. I've seen this happen before in Lutheran congregations. It'll probably happen again. But if you come out with, I think we can all generally agree to a limited extent that war is bad. Let's just put something out there. War is not a good thing. And there will be some, well, I can agree with that. And then you say, well, if war is a bad thing, why are we in it? Then you get into the justification of why political acts are done for particular reasons. And that may be, according in this particular war, we were out to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And that was the justification for the war. And as this gentleman said, we didn't have the facts on it. But once the decision is made, you can't go back and undeclare war after it's already been done. So then do you support your populace that's over there supporting the decision that our Congress made or our President made? Or do you pull them out and say, well, we made a mistake, let's get out. And they say, no, we got to stay in because we want to make Iraq a democracy. Well, that's another, now we've got a different justification.
Yeah.
And now we're going
to make your original point that congregations are afraid of being polarized by a war or a political event that is polarizing our nation and people in the country. And so we do nothing. That's a response to Kristen's question that we could talk about here.
I think in response to that, just by lifting that up, by saying that congregations become polarized, which is very much true, but I think we fall into the trap of what Duane was saying with neoconservatives of making it a partisan issue as opposed to a political one. And then, but I think we're called as the body of Christ to be political, and then I think if you come from a different perspective, if that's possible, from the perspective of Christ, I think Christ calls for peace, always calls for peace and love. And so from that vantage point to then approach the issue might make it not so polarizing. I mean, I would think it'd have to be done very carefully, but
yeah. I almost think that the church isn't necessarily the ones who are stuck in a polarized situation. I believe it's I don't think it's intentional, but it's a political thing. Homosexual and gay issues are now not only church issues as we debate them in all denominations, but it's political now. It's being debated this week in the Senate. The war in Iraq, whether we go to peace, whether we support defense spending or we do little and reduce domestic spending for low-income housing, for low-income families, for food stamps, that has virtually not been funded and has been held back for 3 years because we can't pass a budget resolution that gets those passed. So whether there are issues and we feel polarized and let's not discuss it, we don't have a choice. It's happening. And it is a national issue, a political issue, and a church issue. So how do we still save face and say, well, we can't talk about it because it's polarizing? And I guess one way I think, and I always like to be positive too, is that I think our church locally does a lot for homeless and inclusive, welcoming environments and helping the create shelters and food pantry, and we do a lot, and maybe that's a way that feels safe for us and not to have a dialogue on a national agenda, but it is happening and what we're trying to do on a local way.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're just chipping them out, in my personal view, because I promise you there's a 10,000 member church in Houston, Texas, where the man gets up and has 10,000 members, and he definitely gives a political sermon. And it's not only political, it's partisan. It's as partisan as you want to get. He's going to say, I support President Bush's program to have a constitutional amendment to bar homosexual marriages. he'll come out and say that, and he'll have 10,000 upper middle class people that will pay money for that, and they'll give their money. We don't have a Lutheran congregation in the United States that does that I know of.
Thank God.
Either side of the issue.
The problem is, then you know what happens? We lose by default.
But
we lose by default because the rest of the people are going to go out and do it, and we are a small group of people with particular religious beliefs in the democracy.
People are going to have to raise hands now so I can.
But we're going to lose by default.
David, you want to jump in? Mark, it looked like you wanted to say something.
Well, I'm unwilling to pull up here.
Okay, David.
I'll be very quickly. It's the frustration. I agree with what Damon's saying. Is that I think the Lutheran Church, among most mainline Protestants, flounder for lack of courage. But the courage is not to become partisan. I mean, Duane's point's very helpful to me. The courage is to say, look, who are we as the church? Who are we as the church? And your banner should be able to fly in any congregation along with a banner expressing pain from the other side of the issue, whatever that be, because as Lutherans, we ought to be articulate about the fact that, look, there's no righteous answer here. There's the pain we bring to the foot of the cross. So let's express that pain and be confessional. It's frustrating to me because as Lutherans, we got all the pieces there. It's very frustrating to see us be co-opted by partisanship, like anybody else. And I think the lack of courage is to say, look, to be the church is to be political and not partisan. That's what Duane's first statement, and this is how we're going to do it.
Up in the balcony, share your name before you speak, everybody, and then we can know each other's names more, too.
I'm Scott, and one thing, it's sort of touching on something somebody said earlier about the differences between expectation and politics. But one thing that I noticed, if you look at what Christ did, he confronted evil everywhere. He through neither his actions nor his words could you derive from what he did. The maxim seems to be prevalent today that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and I'll get along with them because they're better than the other guy. And you don't see that much anymore. It's assumed that you're for everything or against everything. And I think that might be part of the issue with the church. The church as a whole is not seen as saying, okay, well, you're doing this and this is good, but you're doing this and this and this, and this is evil, but this is good. And doing it across the board.
Mark wanted to speak, and then Maury, and then Woody, I think.
It may be helpful to share something again from Bonhoeffer here. In 1933, he wrote an essay called The Church and the Jewish Question. And he was very concerned that the confessing church was worried about the Nazi inroads into the church, but was not saying anything about what was happening to the Jews. And behind that is a basic theological belief that every person is a child of God and needs to have full status before God. And there's a theological conviction that's behind that. But another part of that was he identified, he said, three options when the church sees the state is not fulfilling its proper role as the state. He said one option is to call sin by its rightful name. It's not an option, it's something you need to do. A second thing is to reach out and minister to the victims of state action, and certainly we have a tradition of doing that. And the third was to put a spoke in the wheel. And then, you know, that ended up being, in his case, getting involved in conspiracy. I would lift up that I think that's helpful to sort out possible responses for us. But I think we have to be careful not to jump too quickly to thinking in terms of option three, spoke in the wheel, when there are simple, basic things that we can do to affect what's going on in the nation. And at the very least, as Lutherans, and I'm picking up on some things David was saying in terms of vocation, part of our calling is to be active citizens in the fullest sense of the term. And as far as I can tell, democracies do not work when the citizens fall asleep at the wheel. It does not work. And so that's something that we should be able to preach that, to be active citizens in the world, and that would fit very much with what you're talking about. And then we have to, in a sense, not become partisan in doing that, even though we ourselves, as preachers or leaders, may have very particular actions that we will take as citizens too. But surely we can encourage that, and then that's where we start. And that's where I get a little concerned about comparisons of what's going on now, even to Hitler and the Nazi period, when in fact there is an opportunity, if you're really concerned about what's going on, get out and vote. You actually can change the administration if that's your concern, or if you want this administration in office, then get out and vote. That's still an option we have here that could have a major impact.
Maury.
Yeah, I have a slightly different angle on that question about what the church can do without announcing everybody should support Bush or resist it. There are some biblical imperatives, and there are some examples in the life of Christ that we can look to and say, we're supposed to feed the hungry. We're supposed to care for the widow and the orphan. These are not partisan issues. These are things that should be on the political agenda of every party. And when they're not, if they're falling off of the table, as they are sometimes, I think it's appropriate for the Christian church to say, these things need to be, we think, our group thinks these things should be on the political agenda. You're entitled to your opinion, but we're Christians. We have this scripture. We have these imperatives. And then we could encourage our people to be involved politically as individuals to get those things back on the table. And I would, have some things to say about peace also and nonviolence, but not everybody would agree with me on that.
Okay, Woody, you had your hand up, then Dwayne, and then Clara, right? Okay.
I wanted to go back to what Dwayne said about the definition of the term political. That towards we gather together, different self-interests, and limited resources, working it out. You know, it's almost like family. I don't know if there's that amount of trust in our congregations. I talk my own congregation, University of the Church in Seattle. So that's where the conversation, if we want to be political, I don't know. I honestly don't know where the other members of the congregation stand on some of these. What are their self-interests? I work at Boeing, so somebody might think, well, maybe my self-interest is, I think the war is good because it's going to mean more jobs for Boeing. I also have a son who's 16. If there's a draft, he's probably going to get drafted. There's a fear of polarization mentioned earlier. We just don't put the agenda. We don't actually discuss them. It's a matter of trust in our local. I think that's where the politics is local. We really need to get to know each other. It's not just by name, but also by what are the self-interests of the other people in my community, and how do we? And there are going to be differences of opinion, but we're too polite, I think. And I don't. I know that there are people in my congregation opposed to the homosexual question, but when we had the forum, they didn't really feel able to speak their position because they knew they were in the minority and everybody would kind of judge them. And I think that we need to get past that judging and get more towards trust to actually speak our self-interest, and maybe confess, that's where I'm at right now. I don't feel comfortable with what other people are talking about. I feel differently about it. Be able to share that difference in a local congregation.
Doesn't the church have to be careful not to be judgmental in all these things? How far you go, but you're not becoming judgmental in your worship. Worship should not be judgmental. The body of Christ, to me, the body of Christ is supposed to do things, but I'm not sure that it should interfere with our worship, so that we're not getting that love of other people and not getting judgmental and trying to talk about the things that Jesus did and that we should do them. Isn't that more important?
Okay, thank you. Dwayne, you were going to speak next, and then Clara.
think my thought had its day. But
maybe you have another thought.
Maybe. I think this, because this was a really good point.
Yeah.
It's such a hard one for our congregations. In some respects, to me, unfortunately, it says how perhaps we have failed at stewarding and proclaiming the gospel as we should. Because the gospel is about human beings finally knowing that we are so loved and attached to God and to one another that nothing else will sever that, and then yet at the same time we can then be bold in our individual lives to go about things that will even necessarily be partisan. So maybe we're afraid of being judgmental, but whatever happened to the vision that the liturgy holds up, where we would be a community that holds each other accountable. And not accountable as, again, an imposition of a law or some kind of a hard ruler that wraps us on the knuckles, but accountable because we love each other and because our love is secured for us in God. What has happened to the vision of a Lutheran community of moral deliberation, as we've called it, perhaps somewhat ambitiously, at the birth of the ELCA, that would have us be about exploring these issues together, because we know so doggone well that the highest thing of all is there and we're safe in it. So if it's judgmental, it's because we're afraid. We're afraid then because we haven't done the job, I guess, of proclaiming the gospel in its purity. My fear is, I mean, one of the undersides of my job is I get to travel around. So I hear preaching, and, you know, I'm sorry to say, I do hear a lot of failed preaching that the person doesn't know the gospel, or at least not how to communicate it. That's my judgment. I'm being judgmental there, right? Because it happened to have been reduced to moralism. But there's something far more transcendent that we are to be about. Seems to me that the gospel of justification lets us go about that. And that, so yeah, go be partisan in daily life. And as Democrats and Republicans and these days as really frustrating Naderites, you know, really get in each other's face, but know that that's not the ultimate thing. It's become the problem for us because we, like the religious right, have turned that partisan thing into an idol. We've identified it with righteousness of Jesus Christ. Moyer says, get back the hijacked Jesus. In the meantime, you know, in worship, as it were, stir up Democrats' shame on the Republicans. If you're a Republican, tell them shame on you. For the sake of the higher cause, which unites Democrats and Republicans. I don't know about Naderites, but...
I don't either.
Yeah. You know what I mean. There's one thing that holds us together, but we have this predisposition. I suppose it's part of being sinners. We have this predisposition to hold all other kinds of things to the priority place. That's where we get judgmental and we don't act.
Clara. My thought kind of had its day too. It's just a short one. My mom belongs to a church, not Lutheran church, it's a Christian church that's worldwide, and that is, the majority is definitely conservative. She's real liberal. But when I've attended with her sometimes before elections, both particularly national, but also local, they'll say maybe a couple times during, you know, the church day, they'll just, it's part of the service, they'll say, remember to go out and exercise your right to vote, and I don't know that they have, I mean, they'll maybe even put something in there from the Bible that supports that. I don't attend a Lutheran church, and I'm curious, is there anything like that in the Lutheran church? Like, is it ever, before an election, would something like that be said?
Sure.
Go out and vote?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, you
and then Roy, and then Diane, and then Scott. Okay. What's your name?
I'm Joanne.
Joanne. Okay.
And I just wanted to comment on something that was said a long time ago by the gentleman from Texas, whose name I did not know. But the Lutheran Church, he is absolutely right, and the conservative churches have basically come to support this administration and things that it does in the way it does it. And at times that's very offensive to those of us in the Lutheran Church. And there are many of us in the Lutheran Church, because we think of the gospel first, that we don't see a relationship between the gospel and that kind of activity. I wanted to mention that in Phoenix, Arizona, the Lutheran churches there, during the El Salvador situation, brought in refugees and hid them. These pastors are currently being sentenced, aren't they? There's trials still going on. When I was there, even in May, and because it was felt that they, and this was against the U.S. government, these churches felt very strongly that this was the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they acted on that as they saw. I think it is a challenge for all of us. We need to act. Otherwise, we will be rolled over. It's just like a big machine with these conservatives. They will hijack our Jesus. They will put politics and church together, or the current administration and church, which you can say, if we don't act and if we don't come to our own personal convictions and talk about it within the church, maybe not in worship, but eventually going to a worship service that does address those issues and be labeled as a worship service for that purpose.
I'm Roy, and I want to talk about space, or spaces, and where do we do these things? And I think these two buildings help us, that we worshiped in the Village Center. That is essentially the worship place and the worship space, and that is the place where we do proclaim the gospel and administer the sacraments and pray for one another. And this space that we're meeting in right now, this place, can be the place for public forums and debates. I don't want this to sound incorrect, but we can take this cross and this candle out of here, because that can be in the worship space and the worship place. And I heard William Willimon a few years ago, when he spoke at a convocation at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, when he said, changed my mind in terms of this whole vision of the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand. And he said, I now hold them far apart, and as far apart as I can, so that the prophetic voice of the scriptures can address the world. And I think it does have some things to do about where do we have public discussions and forums. Probably in a town hall in a number of little towns across the country, not inside the church building. Remove it.
Okay. Diane.
I think this is it's a different thought, a couple of different aspects to it, but it's When I heard what you said the other day about the ad for Carrie, was it you or was it David?
No, David did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry.
David.
That there was the ad for Carrie with his different vocational hats on. And then when it came to a picture showing him as a man of faith after being a hunter and a father and various sundry other things, the picture for him as a man of faith was the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. And I found myself, when I hear that, when I hear an element of the Republican Party purchasing mailing lists from churches, I find myself, oh, give me an agnostic president, please. You know, just a good humanist that...
Somebody that reached across the aisle.
Well, and that was not from the other side act as if God is on our side. That is the scariest thing to me, whether it is jihad, whether it is terrorists, whether it is the United States, that God is on our side. And it's very deep in the American politic that God is on our side. It's why we're prosperous. And it's, to me, it's a very frightening thing that leads us into a certain kind of arrogant domination in the world. It's because that's what we're called, that's what we're summoned out to do. And the co-opting of religious language into the political arena rather than the other way around is probably what scares me the most. And I have a corrective to that I would have to say was a complete surprise to me, one of those gifts, which was shortly after the invasion of Iraq. I was invited to speak in an adult forum in a Lutheran church in Livermore, California, which is where a site of nuclear development. And when the lecturer got up and was wearing an American flag for a tie that was about 8 inches wide, and then when I picked up a very unfamiliar hymnal, I suddenly realized that I was in a Missouri Synod Lutheran church this morning. That I didn't know, and I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. And the title of the sermon was "Whose Side Is God On?" And I found myself really beginning to shake as to what was about to happen and whether I could sit there. And I wound up hearing one of the best sermons that I ever heard about how God is on the terrorist side. God is on the side of the victims. God is on the side of Israel. God is on the side of Palestine. It was just this incredibly powerful sermon to a congregation that was deeply divided. And that was where I heard the call to gospel. Politics, not partisanship. And that whole murky element of religious language in the public sector is extremely frightening to me. I think that's what leads to totalitarian thinking.
Thank you, Diane. We have time for one more. Scott, your hand was up.
I want to take issue with the idea that political action is something we should only do as individual Christians. I don't think the answer is to, you know, unite your congregation behind a political candidate, but it also isn't just to sit around and talk about it and debate and then never come to a conclusion either. I think there's a place to act collectively without having to all agree together. I don't mean that the church itself takes a stand, but that individuals who are convicted of a certain stand in the political sphere should take that action collectively, because we give so much power when we say we can't do anything together politically in church. We have to just take that outside and do that in the ballot box, whatever. I think there's tremendous power in the church, tremendous political power in the church, and it doesn't have to be something that comes down from Higgins Road or from the pulpit or any place like that. It can happen when people who are convicted of truth and falsehood come together and act together.
Thank you. Well, my watch says 9:30. Thank you for listening, for speaking, for building together a conversation. Thank you to our panelists. Dwayne, oh, you got it.
It's a joke, but okay. It's a Luther quote. I just told Mark I couldn't let it go after Diane's fine thing. Luther said this about political leadership: better a smart Turk than a dumb believer.
So the forum has ended. Let the conversation continue. Thank you for coming. Let's get